Oh, that, yes. I have so many feelings about that, too. Yes.
Yeah. Part two.
Hello, and welcome to Snark Squad Pod, a media podcast full of friendship, feelings, and snark. My name is Marines.
I'm Nicole Sweeney.
And today we are joined by Sam, the Democracy Diva.
Hey, y'all. This is Sam. You can find me on Twitter at Democracy Diva. And of course, I am thrilled to be back on Snark Squad Pod.
Sam is joining us today to talk to us about the Hunger Games trilogy, which we reread partially because there's a new prequel book coming out. So this seemed like a good time. We made this decision, I will say, before we all got locked inside of our homes. I just want to put that out there. And it is now my job to give the plot synopsis, plot summary. I feel like people know what The Hunger Games is, but in case you don't, it is a young adult trilogy set in a future dystopian nation called Panem. We follow a 16-year-old girl named Katniss Everdeen who lives in District 12, which is the poorest of 12 districts in Panem. Part of this dystopian nation is that the super rich and powerful capital has an annual Hunger Games in which two children, a boy and a girl from each of the 12 districts, is sent to the capital to fight to the death and have only one winner. In the beginning of the first book, Katniss's little sister Prim is chosen to go to the Hunger Games. And so Katniss volunteers as tribute. And so she goes into the Hunger Games. She is also sent in with a boy named Peeta, who has been in love with her since she was a little kid. And they manage to both become the victors of their Hunger Games. In the second book, there's a super special Hunger Games called the Quarter Quell, in which instead of children, it's a bunch of victors from previous Hunger Games. And so Katniss and Peeta have to go back in again. And then Katniss like blows up the arena, and surprise, there's a 13th district that has been hiding out, and people from the 13th district are all these rebels, and they like free Katniss. And in the third book, Katniss is in District 13 with the rebels, and the rebels overtake the capital. The rebels win. The capital goes away. Katniss kills President Snow. There's a lot of other stuff going on, but like we're gonna talk about it. And I'm operating under the assumption that you know what the Hunger Games is. I just do not want to give a 10-minute plot synopsis for all of the minutia of these three books.
It is three books, so even if it was something where like we know you know what the Hunger Games is, we also are not going to give a plot synopsis for three books. So.
Right. Just not going to happen.
It's simply not going to happen.
But Nicole has already mentioned that obviously this is something that we all are rereading and is something that is super popular, very much in pop culture. So I'm going to start by asking what we usually ask when we are talking about a franchise, and that is to give a little bit of your background with The Hunger Games, when you originally read it, if you watched the movies, that jazz.
I believe The Hunger Games was one of the things that I started reading because either Mari or Sweeney or both were tweeting about it or talking about maybe they were going to recap it. I know it was around the same time that you were also doing that with Game of Thrones, because, and I may have said this on one of the Song of Ice and Fire podcasts, but I remember learning about both of these things at the same time and not knowing which one was The Hunger Games and which one was Game of Thrones, because they both had game in the title, and that was too confusing for me. So that's a cute, like, innocent part in my life. But I was in law school, and I think I had like just finished exams or midterms or something. And so I think I ate up all three books in like 2.5 days. Like I binge read them, and it was a wonderful distraction from the trials and tribulations of law school. And I guess this was, I don't know, probably around maybe within the year before the movies were coming out. So I think that's why it was getting talked about a lot. And the movies were very important to me because the Hunger Games press tour had the best red carpet fashion in the history of film, in my humble opinion. and so that became, it was kind of the first movie of this modern red carpet era where you're dressing in a way that thematically represents the character you're playing on the show. So they had Elizabeth Banks, who played Effie Trinket, in these like crazy over the top glittering things that like someone in the Capitol in the story would wear. And they had, you know, Jennifer Lawrence in, you know, fire and red and orange, you know, Katniss girl on fire things. And so that was a fun time in pop culture history for me. So I look back fondly on those years. But that's how I initially discovered The Hunger Games.
I should also mention, for anybody who does not know, because for obvious reasons, I guess you didn't include it in your intro. It's not necessarily a thing you're actively doing these days, but Sam used to be a fairly active fashion blogger. So I also very, very vividly remember all of your posts about the Hunger Games press tour.
That was peak, like putting off law school classwork in order to do red carpet commentaries. So that was like, that was the high time on democracyfever.com.
I first read the Hunger Games books sometime in 2010 after I graduated college. When I was in college, I was fairly active in like, I don't know, live journal-y fandom spaces. And one of my closest friends from that sort of space was super into The Hunger Games. And so on her recommendation, I think I was at Target one day and the like hardcover box set had just come out. So I was like, okay, I have nothing else going on in my life right now. I'm living at my parents' house trying to find a job. So I also read them straight through in like 2-3 days. I remember I was actually kind of working at the time and I was like reading on my lunch break and like not really sleeping. So it was a really, really productive 3 days of work for me. But I super loved them, adored them immediately, reread them, I don't know, a couple times between when I like that and then when the movies came out. And so probably rereading in anticipation of the movies is like maybe roughly the time that Sam is describing. Unclear. I definitely reread them for the first and second movie. I forget whether or not I did it for the third and fourth movies. But yeah, I really loved the movies as well. I did not rewatch them as part of this like prep for the podcast episode. I only reread the books, but I probably had not reread them for several years prior to this rereading experience.
I have no memory of when I originally read this trilogy. I have like, I cannot put it into context at all. And even checking into Goodreads, like I have them marked as read, but I have them marked as read for the day that I joined Goodreads in 2011. So I'm assuming that my reading them for the first time predated that. And I know that we did like a reread thing through at that time, Childhood Trauma, before it was even Snark Squad. And I started to reread the first book. I don't think that I even got through that reread with the rest of everybody. Even though I tweeted a little bit about like the first quarter of the book that I was reading or whatever it was. But so I've read these through specifically second and third books one time, and that was it. Then the movies came out, and I don't know. This is a story that lives really strongly in my memories, but I don't remember when I read them, what age, what context at all. So it was really, really interesting for me to go back and read them because it felt in a lot of ways, like even though I'm so familiar with the story, I'm familiar with the story because of the movies.
Right.
So it felt like reading them for the first time, which was super enjoyable and very interesting. And so I guess that leads us into the question of if you liked them this time around. I mean, obviously Nicole's reread them a bunch, but did you like it? Did you like rereading it, even though we made this decision before the end of the world? and how was that? How was rereading it in 2020, in the year of our Lord 2020, in quarantine?
this was a bold choice, rereading this during the pandemic. I reread all three twice in the last like 3 weeks because what the hell else was I gonna do? I think I always really liked the books. I tend to be the kind of reader who on the first read, I don't read super critically. Something has to be really, really bad for me to hate it on first read. I'll hate things more on second read when I'm paying closer attention to details. Mm-hmm. So I was expecting to be frustrated by, you know, some of the cheesier elements. You know, the names are ridiculous and the made up words that only exist in like Panem are even more ridiculous. And so there's some things that I had to just be like, oh, okay, I guess we're just gonna call them that. All right. I can't say Plutarch Heavensby with a straight face ever in my life. So it's a real shame. It's a real shame that that had to be a major character. But aside from that, I think the parts that I loved, I still love. It was a little bit suffocating to read under these circumstances, but in a way that I think enhances the experience, because I felt like I was drowning in the world along with Katniss. Mm-hmm. And whether that's when she's actually in the games or, you know, when she's in 13 in the third book and like feeling suffocated underground or just not being able to, you know, leave the house without people recognizing her. I don't know. It all felt exacerbated and like extra. And more, it just felt more rereading mm-hmm. it while literally being unable to leave my house. And you know, the president pitting states against each other for who gets a ventilator. That felt mm-hmm, real. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I also really enjoyed this experience of rereading. I was a little bit nervous, to be perfectly honest. Like I much like Sam, was expecting to be a lot more critical of it this time around. And I feel like, if anything, my love for the books grew through this experience, because I was like, no, this fucking holds up. I feel like when I first read these books, there are a number of other things that I liked back then that I don't necessarily still enjoy. So I was kind of unsure how I was going to feel. Much like Sam, particularly the third book, I agree, felt there were certain things about it that I was like,
so too real.
This is very intense. So yeah, all around, I enjoyed myself to the degree that one can enjoy this experience.
It's 3 for 3 on going in very tentatively. I've grown up so much over the last few years, and I've also grown up as like a media consumer and critic. So I knew that the person that was going into this was going to be more critical of the books than the person who read it some point pre-2011. Mm-hmm. And so I was very, very, very hesitant. But not only does this trilogy hold up, but I feel like I got something out of it when I read it originally, and I got other things out of it as an older adult. It's one of those things that, yeah, I don't know, it feels like it grows with you.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, these are so simply written, and so part of the reason that they have mass appeal is that the concept is not necessarily like super simple, but it's a very close perspective. You're with Katniss's feelings the entire time, and it's just very simply written. So it does have that element of having like mass appeal. At the same time, like I said, anytime that I feel like I'm going to go into these stories, I'm going to gain something new. And I think that adds, it's because of all of the political stuff that she weaves in. It's because you view Katniss as a character differently, as I think I probably closer to her age, I probably saw her one way. And now as like a 33-year-old, I'm like, oh no, you child. Oh no, baby. So these are spectacular. I really, really love them. And as hard as they were to read at times, I also truly enjoyed my experience reading them. So
I was also super struck by that, the thing that you're describing in terms of like the age gap, like the age difference. So reading this for the first time at, you know, 22, straight out of college, like technically an adult, but like functionally,
but let's be real,
like functionally a child. Whereas, you know, like now being an adult, and, you know, like PETA has his kind of line that he repeats a couple times throughout, you know, that she has no idea the effect that she can have. And like reading it this time around, one of the things that I noticed that I don't think that I have particularly latched onto in previous rereads is how much sense it makes to me that all of these other adults that like Katniss doesn't view as giving a shit about her are aware of her, and are aware that like people know this girl, this child basically has been doing her darndest to take care of her family since she was quite small. And like the problem is that nobody really has anything in District 12, so there's not really a ton that anybody can do to like actively help her and her family besides, you know, making generous trades, I guess, with her, right? But like in her head, she's like, yeah, we're making fair trades, right? But like actually what's going on is that all of the different people that she is dealing with are doing the very tiniest little bit that they can to like help this girl. I don't know. That was something that really, really stood out to me. The dynamic between Katniss and the other adults of District 12. Now that I am also an adult and like trying to imagine being aware of this 16-year-old girl. I don't know. That was a very, very interesting thing about this particular rereading experience.
I agree that reading these books in your 30s, I mean, like any media aimed at teenagers, experiencing it as a young person or, you know, a 24-year-old law student who, again, should be, but is functionally not an adult, versus at least somewhat more of an adult now. But I think what struck me is that, at least for me personally, what works so well and what works most for me in these books is how much they are about image and how other people perceive you and the building of a revolutionary icon, mm-hmm. and what the public relations strategy behind that looks like. I think it works way better as like an indictment of PR and celebrity than it necessarily does as a dystopian war series. Mm-hmm. Because for me, all of the strongest points are about how they built up the Katniss image outside of her control, how the Capitol, you know, tore it down when they realized she was too much of a threat, and how the rebel side in District 13 used that and capitalized on that and still made, you know, this image of Katniss that wasn't who she was. And Katniss being, you know, no matter who was at the helm, someone else was controlling her voice and her looks and her makeup and her hair and her everything. And watching how you make up a young girl to be a revolutionary and to lead a revolution has always been the thing that like packs the biggest punch in this series for me. And that's something that I really felt deeply on this reread, was the strength of the novel for me lying in how it takes on celebrity more than mm-hmm. how it takes on a dystopian, you know, future war.
I have there's so many different ways to go, like, from this conversation. I'm sitting here like, okay, wait, I want to send you 27 different things. But the thing that all of this, to me, reading it in 2020, the thing that I took most away from it is that I feel like when I originally read it, it felt so much more removed from like something that could actually happen. And I feel like there was always that sort of criticism against it, like that the premise of it is so far out there. Like, who would do this? Who would send their children to fight to the death? And that is what I found myself like drowning in, as Sam said, rereading this. So many of the like little details of what the Capitol was doing to keep the districts in line. And so much of it, like, you know, is this idea of what Nicole was talking about of, you know, the different ways that people are pitted against each other. So nobody in District 12 has much of anything. And so they cannot help each other. And it's very much throughout the whole series, this idea of like the individual versus like the collective versus the Capitol kind of overseeing it all. And that dynamic between how much people are helping each other, but at the end of the day, when you put them in certain situations, it's every man for themselves. And that is what a lot of the Hunger Games kind of symbolizes, is that, you know, nobody wants to be there, but they're still playing the game. And the way that as soon as they're in the arena, especially in the second book, all of these people who know each other and were holding hands the day before are immediately like, okay, time to kill each other. Mm-hmm. So that dynamic, and just the dynamic of like, okay, it's 2020 and it's no longer so difficult to imagine a society that would do this, or that would pit each other against each other in this way, or I don't know, just the entire thing. It's like almost a little bit overwhelming to talk about just the ways that I was like, I don't know, I buy it more. In 2020, mm-hmm. I just buy more.
I do too.
Well, and also kind of going back to Sam's point, the ways in which it's exploring the idea of like celebrity. And I think, Sam, you were talking a lot about how you have all of these other outside players trying to decide Katniss's persona and whatnot. But the other thing that they kind of keep coming back to, and this comes up in the third book in particular, is this idea of authenticity. And, mm-hmm. and there is like a really weird sort of tension between they can only get something usable out of Katniss when they get her to do something authentically. But like, even then, it's still going to be like cut and curated, and right. I think there is also something interesting about thinking about that in this sort of particular moment, this like the kind of media and self-branding landscape in which we live now is different than the one in which I first read the books, for sure. So, like, thinking about it from that perspective, too, the idea of Katniss is only effective as a revolutionary when you can tap into something that is authentically her, but, like, it's still a packaged authenticity. Like, it's not...
It's still mediated, right? It's still curated. So, no matter how... And even though it is her spontaneity and her fire and her that people are reacting to, well, nobody gets to see that fire and that spark unless the cameras are rolling.
Right.
Which is, again, extremely relatable to all of us who have not been able to speak to another human being unless we live with them, except through a mediated conversation. So, like, you know, relevant.
I think another thing that has really kind of evolved since these books originally came out and that add to the sense of, like, I don't know, we're headed in that direction is just, it ties back to that idea of, like, celebrity PR, but also, like, reality TV. And I think one of the strongest things to me on reread in the first book was everything leading up to the games. Like, I didn't remember how much time you spend out of the games leading up to the games. And all of that, I think, was the most real part of the games to me, was the interviews, the training, the outfits, just everything leading up to it. And then all of the people in the Capitol just eating it up and, like, tuning in and watching in and buying into this, like, very, very, very heavily edited and put on production, you know, because it's interesting, it's entertaining, you know, it's blood and guts and gore. And isn't that, you know, what people enjoy watching? So that part of it just kind of rung in a different way to me in 2020 as well. And just this idea of, I think, the way that the games just continue to make a victim out of the people who are in them. So you get picked, you have to sit on that stage and actively participate in your interviews. If you want to win, if you want to survive, you've got to make people like you. You've got to put on this whole persona. You've got to do the whole thing. Then you're in the games and, you know, God forbid you win, because then for the rest of your life, you're a mentor to watch other people go in and get killed. And then, you know, there's the whole tour, the publicity tour they have to go on after they win. It's like a never-ending cycle. Right. And so to watch that happen and then also watch, like, Katniss realize this, that she's never going to escape this, and then tie that back to, like, the control that the Capitol has in general in the society, like, that was something that I was like, ooh, it hurts, it hits home.
And it's really interesting thinking about that too, rereading, and, like, in book two when she meets all of the other victors, like, having all of this context for these people that Katniss does not yet have, like, because she is still kind of working through these things herself, and, like, it still doesn't fully occur to her that other people have also, like, had to process these emotions, which is, like, classic 17-year-old bullshit, right? I don't fault Katniss for this.
There are 73 other victors of the Hunger Games, but I'm the only one who's struggling.
You know, I get it. I get that. It was also just really, really interesting to kind of see that and to see all of the ways in which, I don't know, she's, like, missing it. She's not fully connecting those dots until later, until they're, like, really spelled out for her.
I also think that on first read, I was very into how much these books focus on fashion, but I was particularly interested in how they focus on fashion as a political statement, or fashion as a way of saying something about more than just, you know, clothing. And again, as someone who was heavily blogging about the red carpet at the time I was reading that, that was an interesting hook in for me. I think on reread, you know, 8-ish years later, having consumed a lot more media, including a lot more late night television, I'm, like, obsessed with Caesar Flicker. Role in on reread. He is the host of he's Stanley Tucci in the movie, so, like, obviously that's iconic to begin with. But he's the late night interview host who conducts these interviews with all of these kids who are about to, you know, be shipped off to murder each other. And his charisma and kindness and care while being, you know, a cog in an evil machine are so fascinating to me. And the things I find myself wanting to unpack the most about the series are the people like that, are the people who were raised in the Capitol mind frame, who have never had to struggle, who have never had to worry that they or their kids would be sent to the Hunger Games. You know, him and Effie and Cinna, Katniss's stylist. All I want to know is more about what they think of the world world and how they got to where they are and why they do what they do. Because the way the books give them depth in a way that I think other books wouldn't is really magical to me. And I think the series leans really heavily on that and kind of does that with a lot of intention. In the third book, Katniss has a whole team of people who styled her for the Hunger Games. They killed her stylist, Cinna, right before she went into the arena the second time, right in the second book. But when she's in District 13, it turns out that the rest of her prep team, like her makeup artist and hairstylist, have been, you know, captured by 13 and held under horrific conditions. And she has a lot of difficult talks with people, with Gale, I think, about, you know, why she cares about these people who spent the last year dressing her up for slaughter and, you know, picking out the lipstick she was going to die in. And Gale couldn't understand why Katniss cared about them. And Katniss really couldn't either. But it was, it reflects the themes in the story of not everybody on the good side is good and not everybody on the bad side is bad. And President Coyne is just as power hungry and manipulative as President Snow is. It doesn't matter that they're on opposite sides. And so I like how the book used those kinds of characters to kind of give you that insight. And that's something that packed a punch with me on this reread more than previous ones.
And they do a really good job of doing that through Katniss too. So we talked about this quite a bit in our, we've been doing like a Discord chat around these books, but we talked a lot about who Katniss is as a character and like the flaws that she has. Her as a character in the beginning of this series, she is incredibly like rigid and like stern and unforgiving. There's a line going into the opening ceremony of the Quarter Quell. She, like, Katniss is like relieved because she isn't being told to wave this time. Cinna tells them to just like stand and like sort of be above it all. And she says, "We are unforgiving and I love it, getting to be myself at last," which, like, yeah. Getting to be unforgiving is like getting to be herself at last, because she really, really is. At the outset, she's incredibly hard for reasons that track, like, it, you know, it makes sense that she is this way given the life that she has lived. But it's interesting that she goes through so much worse than the life that she had lived up to that point and emerges more forgiving. And so, like, she does have this complicated journey where she, you know, in the first book, she cannot stand her prep team. Like, they are a source of tremendous frustration for her. She is horrified by the fact that they can sit there and like doll her up and not really give a shit that she'll, you know, as far as they are concerned, she'll be dead in a week. So like, there's that. And she does go through the journey of precisely what you are describing, Sam, in terms of like understanding that, like, it's complicated. People are fucking complicated and circumstances are complicated. And like, I don't understand why I care about the people who dressed me up for slaughter, but like, also I kind of do.
Right. And I think I like that you talk about the unforgiving stuff. I think that we see that so heavily with Katniss's relationship with her mother.
Yes.
Katniss's father dies in a mining accident when Katniss is like 11 and Prim, her sister, is like 7. And basically Katniss's mother goes into like a very, very, very serious depression that closes her off to the world and makes her unable to care for her children. But Katniss was 11. She didn't know that her mom had a mental health problem. She didn't know that this wasn't her mother's fault. All she knew was that she was 11 and had to lead her family. Uh-huh. And so, of course, she's going to be 16 and not forgive her mother for that. Uh-huh. Is that fair? No. Does it make sense? Of course.
Right.
And I like that the series grapples with things like that. I like that it trusts you and it trusts Katniss enough to know that, like, Katniss is going to sound really fucking harsh about her mom, who, you know, was a broken person. Mm-hmm. and who even says in the books, you know, if I had the medicine then that I have now, I would have been, you know, it was beyond my control. And I like that the audience trusts you enough to know that this doesn't mean Katniss is evil. It means she's complicated.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that she'll never forgive her mother. It means that she needs to go through some more shit before she can.
Right.
But I do love what you said about how somehow, even though she's only going through worse and worse things, she does find it in her to forgive her mother, and she does find it in her to forgive herself for the trauma that she's caused and the death that she's brought. This is a good series, y'all.
I think that some of those like deeper things or like the complexities that I was like, oh man, I didn't see this all, I guess, when I read it the first time. And part of that is just rereading and reconsuming the story. But I love the way that it does present this complex cast of characters. And in general, it is saying people are complicated. And one of the things that I really, really loved this time around was the fact that it did give us really complicated and very different looks at post-traumatic stress disorder, about trauma, about surviving, things like this. So you do have her mom who kind of goes within herself, and you have Katniss that gets very hard, and you have, you know, all of the victors in the second book, and they're all presented in different ways. There are some people who are drunks like Haymitch, and there's two of them who are using drugs, and there's, you know, Finnick over there, like just doing his swagger thing to like mask everything that's going on. So it shows us all of the different ways that people are coping with the trauma. And I just love the way that it says that as well. Like, hey, people are complicated. They deal with really tough things in different ways, and all of it is bad, but all of it is okay, kind of thing. Uh-huh. And then just also showing us Katniss, you know, be the survivor that she is and be amazing. You know, you do really fall for her, because even though she's unforgiving, she's the biggest bleeding heart in this entire freaking story. Mm-hmm. And so anytime she sees anybody remotely in danger or anything, she's like running headfirst into that danger to be like, no, stop it, for better or worse. But, you know, as she gets exposed to the world more and she kind of leaves her meadow, her family and District 12, she does start to really flesh out as a person and as a character. And she starts to realize what you as the reader realize, and that is that the system is bad, but the people in it are complicated, and there's good and bad on both sides.
We've been talking a lot about the rereading experience and all of the kind of new, bigger picture, nuanced things that stand out. I feel like I also want to acknowledge the thing that hooked me initially, and the thing that will always be part of why this series means so much to me, I guess, is the initial sister feels.
Of course. We are all suckers for those.
Right. Like, I don't know how many times I've read these books now, but I will never not be able to cry when Katniss volunteers his tribute. It took me maybe 20 times of seeing that clip in the movie before I could watch it without crying. Like, it was on all the fucking trailers, and I was like, cool. So every time I see this trailer, I'm just going to cry. Like, that's what's going to happen. So that's great. Love that for me. But this also ties back, though, to everything that Mari was saying about kind of the different ways that you cope and move on. And like, I think that it is interesting that like part of Katniss's way of coping, yes, was that, you know, she became very hard and very rigid. But the other thing, too, is that like she coped by taking care of her sister, and like her sister became this really important place that like she held on to hope, like for all of the ways in which she became like rigid and hard after the trauma of losing her father. Her sister was also this place of like, here is goodness. Here is where I can see and like hold on to and cling to the idea of goodness. And I don't know, there's just something incredibly beautiful and lovely about it. And I love it.
And I love that feeling for Katniss exists in Prim, but it also exists in Rue, the young tribute that she takes care of in the first book, because Rue reminds her so much of her sister. And again, Katniss being able to see that humanity in everyone is what kind of fills these books with richness for me. I also wanted to talk about the post-traumatic stress disorder stuff, because I feel like not everybody likes the third book. I really like the third book.
Me too.
I have some like major deal breaker flaws with it, but there are a lot of things I love about it. Most of it is the media propaganda image side of it, but the grappling with Katniss's PTSD from beginning to end of that book is something, at least at the time, other YA novelists were not doing a lot of. You weren't spending like the end of each Harry Potter book like unpacking how fucked up everybody was because of everything that had happened to them. And like maybe that would have been a better epilogue than the Harry Potter series got. But although to be fair, I think anything would have been better than that. But that is a conversation for a different episode. But I think what makes the third book work in a way that makes the third and fourth movies not work is that on the page, I can get very into just watching the effects of trauma on Katniss. When you're watching a movie, it is less exciting to see someone in a hospital bed for like 70% of a movie. I much more enjoyed following that story in the books because of the ability to be inside Katniss's head. That's what makes that perspective interesting to me, is her own internal confusion brought on by, you know, the physical trauma of concussions, the emotional and psychological trauma of everything she's gone through, and all the different ways that this manifests in her physically and mentally and emotionally, and all the ways that it manifests in other people. You know, Joanna has different PTSD, you know, triggers and symptoms than Katniss does, and Peeta and Finnick and Haymitch, and they all have different ways of coping or forcing themselves not to think about it. And all of these things manifest themselves in different ways in different people, because trauma is complicated and surviving is complicated, and the stories we have to tell ourselves to get through the day are complicated. And I love the way the third book deals with that.
It's also part of how the books counteract the meme about them that I now have very, very strong feelings about how bullshit it is. One of the things that I was like struck on this reread is the idea that these books are about one teenage girl who saves the day while obsessing over which of two boys she's in love with is like the exact opposite of what these fucking books are. That's like wholly, completely the opposite. And I think I totally agree with you. I think that the third book has a really, really interesting exploration of Katniss's PTSD. And it's like, as she spends most of the book like crawling into like closets to like take a nap, basically.
Talk about relatable.
It's which like one, super fucking relatable, and two, she's crawling into closets to take a nap or whatever, because she is not the one who was leading the revolution. Like, that's not what's happening. That's not what this book is actually about. While she's in a closet taking a nap, the people who are whatever, like who are in power, are doing all of those things, and then she's being brought in to do her sort of like figurehead stuff.
Right.
She misses actually a great deal of the action.
Yes.
in terms of the revolution that's happening in the third book, because like that's not what the third book is about, really. Like that's like the big sort of like, I don't know, theater piece that's like in the background, but like really the third book is about her going through this like PTSD journey.
Yes.
I think the biggest difference for me in rereading was that I was one of those people when I originally read Mockingjay, I was like, I hate that ending. I feel like I had talked about it in ways that were like, this is an example of a trilogy that doesn't work at the end, or like examples of my least favorite endings ever. And part of that goes back to the sister feels and the fact that after everything, Prim still dies. But rereading it, I was like, yeah, checks out.
Rereading it, you're like, Prim has to die.
It's just everything comes together in a way that is true to the story, true to the world that she built, true to Katniss's experience, to her trauma. Katniss cannot live happily ever after. That was never going to be Katniss's story. And she gets a piece of like, you know, of resolution or whatnot, and it's still like really freaking sad to read about, but I don't know, it this time around I know why I didn't enjoy it, but I think that what I was experienced was like in story reasons of like, this is sad and it's hurting my feelings, and it wasn't out of story or like, you know, this is badly written or it doesn't fit. It fits perfectly for an ending of this trilogy. Yeah.
I remember having a conversation with you about this in an art museum in Dallas. I don't know if you remember this, but I remember like talking to you about this book however many years ago we were in Dallas. Or maybe it wasn't that trip, but because I don't remember Sarah being part of this conversation. But regardless, I remember walking around an art museum and like having a really, really intense conversation with you in which I tried to defend the ending of this book, and you were like, no. Unacceptable.
Yes, my feelings were hurt. Prim dies. Prim dies, dude.
Prim dies. Deal breaker. Deal breaker for Mari. Stop giving us sister feels. I didn't love the ending when I first read it, but I definitely didn't hate it either. And again, now with some more wrinkles and gray hairs on me, you know, I don't know anyone who has survived the Hunger Games, but I was raised by the children of Holocaust survivors, which I think is about as close of a real life example as you can get. So I know what long-term PTSD looks like for people who went through incredible, incredible trauma in their youth and lost everything and everyone. And what happiness looks like for them is being alive and having a family afterwards. It's not the nightmares being gone, because the nightmares don't leave. And so as someone who, you know, maybe I didn't have the words to call it PTSD when I was, you know, 14 and taking care of my grandfather. But like, what I see in that epilogue is the true happy ending to my grandparents' lives in a kind of, I didn't expect to get here in this episode, so sorry, I'm stammering a little bit now. But what I saw in the epilogue feels true to the real survivors of horrific trauma that I've known in my life. You know, you have to not expect happiness to look like everything's fine now. You have to expect happiness to look like this is how we're able to build a life and move forward. And nothing is the same as it was before. But that doesn't mean it's not better. That doesn't mean we're not going to, you know, be some version of okay. We just have to redefine what okay looks like for us. And I think that's a beautiful thing in a YA story, in any story, but especially in a YA story.
I think that, you know, more than expecting, I guess, like now looking back on it, what I was really feeling was not necessarily the lack of like a happily ever after, but it was the injustice. Like I was so mad for Katniss because of the injustice of it all, because she deserved more. And she at the end of the day was used by every single person in the story, including the revolution and the rebels. And as soon as that her purpose was served, they were like, okay, now go away. She had no role in the new society that she helped create. And so that injustice of it was what rankled me originally.
And she didn't even get the one and only thing she had ever been trying to get, which was saving Prim.
Yes. Right. And so that was like what I was like, this is awful in a way that I didn't process. I mean, it is still 100% awful, but yes, that is this story. That is the end of the story. But with still what Sam is saying, that hopefulness or that idea of like, okay, even though that happened to her and everybody is wrong for what they did to Katniss, she still found a way to put things together and have a family and continue to live. Because at the end of the day, you know, we've been talking about Katniss kind of on and off here, but one of the things that Katniss very much is at her core is a survivor. And that is why she ends up as the main character of the story. And, you know, she gets put in these situations where time and time again, you know, not only it's survival for herself, but also for others around her. When push comes to shove, her instinct is to save others and to help others as well. So
here's my question and my thing that I was hoping to solve in reread and couldn't. I think the ending makes sense. Again, like unfairness, but I mean, like narratively, Prim dying makes sense. The PTSD epilogue makes sense. Her killing Coin instead of Snow makes sense. Why did she say yes in the meeting to have another Hunger Games at the end of the third book? I have never gotten a satisfying answer for Coin. So Coin brings together all the victors who are still alive, right? Which is like 7 people, because as I think the book smartly pointed out, they were targeted from both sides, the rebels and the Capitol. The victors of the Hunger Games were slaughtered en masse, as were their teams. And so at the end, they're faced with the decision of, in order to kill fewer numbers of people, should we have one last Hunger Games using Capitol children in order to not have to slaughter thousands of Capitol, you know, people who worked and served the Capitol. And Katniss says yes in a way that the text is telling you, like, she's saying yes, but only for a real reason. Like what I've read is like, oh, well, you know, she wanted to get on Coin's good side and like, you know, like give the false illusion that like the false illusion that she was on Coin's side. But I don't think that tracks at all. It wasn't only Katniss's decision to decide to do the Hunger Games or not. So first of all, it wasn't even like a Katniss, you're either with us or against us thing. Like that wasn't even how the discussion of this was set up.
Yeah, but it was framed as Coin's idea. Like Coin did make a point of saying that it was her idea. So like, I don't know, to me, it read as like sort of half coming from that place of trying to make sure that Coin felt that Katniss was with her. Like that to me, that is part of the vibe that I get from that.
For me, it's just always that what would have changed right after that meeting if she had said no to another Hunger Games? they still would have handed her her bow to go out and shoot snow. Like, that was still the next thing she was going to do, you know, like, because this happened right before that. So I guess I'm just, I understand in theory why those things could make sense, but I don't think the book actually does the work to show you that.
I think that District 13 in general was super interesting to read about and just coin because of the way that it's showing, like, again, the complexity of, like, the good versus bad, quote unquote, sides, and just the way that the system kind of breeds these things, because 13 is obviously kind of the shown as, like, the right side of this whole thing, but also it is born out of this entire system and it is very broken as well. And so to me, that moment always read as a lot of things coming together for Katniss, because people, well, Snow specifically was trying to kind of tell her or warn her about coin and this idea that, you know, they were replacing one bad thing with another, maybe not so bad, but, you know, still not the right thing. And so when coin comes in there is like, how about one last Hunger Games? It always read to me as a moment where that kind of clicks for Katniss and she's like, we're just going to do this again. Right. And so that agreeing was less to be like on coin's side, but like the quickest way to get out of that room and get the bow in her hand.
Okay, and there is a strong sense, yeah, in the text too, of like her sense of resignation that like, this is what we are, this is what we've become. Yes. And yes.
Like if she had said no, then what I'm sure she could have expected was like pushback from Coin or other people in the room, like Joanna, who voted yes very loudly. Right. And so she was like, yes, let's move it along. I know what I need to do. And so that was kind of the sense of it. It was like a dawning. And I'm not sure if she knew at that moment that she was going to kill Coin. I think that really came together for her when she was holding the bow and she was standing there. Right. But it was like the beginning of like, we just got here at the very end of this and you're proposing a Hunger Games? Like, that brought it full circle for her.
I guess for me, what would have been satisfying was we don't actually see Katniss dismantle the system that is the Hunger Games, because she just kind of gets like basically exiled after that. So we know at the end that there are no more Hunger Games, but we don't actually know why, because Coin is dead. Well, she's not the only one who thought they were a good idea, you know, including some of the other victors. So I guess I wish there was just more connective tissue between Katniss saying yes, but like, obviously I don't want the games to continue, but I'm saying yes because it works with whatever my plan is here. But then we just sort of have a gap between that and there are no more Hunger Games. Like, lovely, glad to hear it. But like, how did we actually get from A to B?
I think my biggest complaints about the book, specifically books 2 and 3. First book, I think, is my favorite. I think it is the strongest in a lot of ways. 2 and 3 are great and they have really great things, but I think the weakest parts of it both come at the end. And it's this sort of like, because we follow Katniss so closely and because she's not part of the action always, both of those books have these weird cuts away from the action. And then this just like page of like plot dump of like, oh, so while I was out, here's what happened. And it's literally the most important stuff that's happening. Like, oh, by the way, while I was waiting in a room, they had my trial. We have a whole new society. There's no more Hunger Games. Bye, everyone. And I was just like, wow.
I think y'all have made me feel better about that issue. So I appreciate that. But yeah, I think it definitely is the case that I think actually all three books do end with somewhat of an info dump of, while you were unconscious, here's what happened in the world.
I mean, that's definitely better than like Stephanie Meyer in Twilight having Bella sleep but still narrating what's happening to us. So I appreciate Suzanne Collins like telling us in summary what happened while her character was knocked out, but still I didn't really remember in the first one, but I guess all three books end that way where she's like knocked out and she comes to and she's like, oh my God, so much happened.
Right.
which is one of the negative things that I have to say about the books.
Right. And that honestly, like, I don't have a lot of negatives. It is like some of those gaps in it that are, you know, like you said, a lot of the gaps in the narrative are because we're telling all of this from Katniss's perspective. So that, and obviously there are things she doesn't know. I don't think the books guide you through those gaps as elegantly as they could. That would be one of my one of my takeaways. Also, Suzanne Collins loves to explain her metaphors. That is something I did not notice on first read, that on this read, I was like, oh no, we get it. You don't have to give us the full script of the song, The Hanging Tree, and then explain each verse and exactly how it's about, mm-hmm. you know, wanting your partner to join you in death. It's like, no, we got that because we read the lyrics, which you printed helpfully in this book. Or she does the same thing with the game that they play with the cat of making the cat chase the laser. Uh-huh. And Katniss goes mm-hmm. on for three paragraphs about how, like, I am the cat and PETA is the laser and the capital mm-hmm. is controlling him. And it's like, no, you could just talk about the cat and we would understand that it represents something deeper because we're reading books and we know how books work.
She does it with the, like, the Mockingjays too, and like a lot of the, like, symbolism of what the capital, like, uses as weapons or whatnot. It's very, very, very on the nose.
Yes. And just a few of those that are like, yes, we get it. We would have gotten it even without the three paragraphs afterwards explaining it. But, like, go ahead, girl.
We are, like, winding down here. We have to wrap up this episode, but we can't end without coming back to something that Nicole said about, like, the memes that were happening when this was at its heyday. And part of that was, like, one girl chosen to save the world. Not true. But the other part is, while choosing between two boys.
Also not true.
Also not true. But I want to just talk about PETA and Gale. Not necessarily them as characters, but we can. But just that idea of, like, the love triangle. And if you viewed that differently, like, rereading and your whole thought process about how Collins uses it in the story and its, like, role within the story.
So the biggest thing that like, stood out to me was not a thing where, like, I was thinking about it differently necessarily so much as I was, like, just acutely aware of, like, the degree to which I feel that this is just, like, that meme is not true. Like, the whole thing, the whole reason that, like, it is protracted throughout, the triangle or whatever drags on is because Katniss keeps thinking, I do not have time to think about this. Like, every time one of these boys expresses their feelings for her, she's like, I'm sorry, I want to not die. And so, like, that's my priority right now. I will get back to you. Like,
there is nothing better than Katniss's just not utter disdain for the boys, but utter disdain for a world that prioritizes them and her relationship status with them over, you know, the revolution, and her, like, utter resignation with every, like, adult manipulator in her life being like, oh, well, would you prefer if we have Gale be your on-screen lover instead? And she's like, bitch, I did not say that, nor would I think it. Like, what are we talking about?
What the fuck is that question?
And again, it plays into what I love about the PR and the propaganda and the celebrity aspect of this is, like, the romance is in there because telling the fake story of the star-crossed lovers was a survival tactic and was later a revolutionary tactic, and keeping the Katniss storyline of, you know, the star-crossed lovers and what is called, if you call them, coal that was turned into pearls. but that idiotic story of these kids who survived so much and, you know, only want to be with each other, like, that's an act, and it might become true, and some of it started true, and the interest of the story is how you figure out what's true and what isn't when you are playing this up for the cameras for survival, but you also have a crush on this guy because you're 16.
Right.
And I love that. I don't, first of all, I think people in general are way too hard on, like, oh, you know, the 16-year-old girls only thinking about boys. I'm like,
fuck you.
Okay, but, like, 16-year-olds in general tend to be thinking about sexual partners in general. So, like, that's what I thought about at 16. So I have no problem with that. But like Nicole said, it's like, no, did you read these books backwards? Like, the point is that the boy stuff is ridiculous. And that Katniss never wants to be more focused on that than she is on saving her goddamn sister or feeding her fucking family.
I think too that the thing that was, like, ugh, such a gut punch to me was that this idea of, like, how everything in Katniss Alice's life is weaponized against her.
Yes.
And so it is like protecting her sister, protecting her family. I mean, she loves to hunt. She can't even do it. It's illegal. And then they take this thing of like her relationship with her best friend and the guy that she goes into the games with, and that those relationships are weaponized against her as well. So yes, she's like constantly thinking about this, but it's because people keep using it against her or as a strategy or whatever it is.
And on both sides, right? That's, yes. That's the magic of this story, is that it's not just weaponized by her enemies. It's weaponized by her friends. It's weaponized by the people she's ostensibly standing with and fighting with. And that's what makes the third book interesting for me.
And also periodically weaponized by Gale himself, which is why he doesn't get picked.
He's the worst. but like, you know, the whole thing with Katniss too. And so we talked a little bit about like the difference of reading this as being older. And so it really struck me like this idea of like the privilege of having a childhood and just the different ways that the districts are shown like they're, you know, how they're repressed or worse or better than each other in relations. So Katniss does not have the privilege of having a childhood, and she's trying so hard to protect that for Prim. And so mm-hmm. even her relationships with like what should be like a crush on a boy or her best friend or whatever, they don't get to exist normally. She does not have the privilege of any of this existing normally. So this idea of like it being like very heightened, very dramatic and kind of in your face, like yes, because she's living this out in front of everybody. It is no longer like a crush on a boy. It is a strategy to topple a regime. Like she does not get the luxury of it just being a simple thing. And you start mixing in the fact that, you know, Snow is like threatening their lives and, you know, the back and forth of all that. And it just was another tragedy on top of all of the tragedy that befalls our poor Katniss Everdeen.
To Sam's point about how like people are generally way too harsh on the idea of like teenagers thinking about their crushes and stuff. Totally agree. One of the things that has always stood out as the most improbable things about this story is that after the like beautiful, sweet day that Peeta and Katniss have on what is supposed to be their like last day of prep before they go into the Quell, the fact that neither one of them is like, you know, we're like probably about to die virgins. What if we don't? That to me.
Literally the least realistic thing about this book that involves like talking birds sometimes is that they don't have sex.
Is that Katniss and Peeta do not have sex before the Quell. Right. I buy it before the first games. Like, you know, Katniss doesn't trust him, whatever. But like at this point in time, Katniss knows she has some kind of feelings for Peeta. Like, come on.
And they're already spending the night together on the train. Like, yes. They're already, like,
everyone thinks they're having sex. You might as well.
Right.
Try it out, girlfriend.
We are truly the mentors Katniss needed. Haymitch was never going to give her this talk. Right.
Just like going off of that, I just kind of looking back on this retrospectively, especially because thinking about like the movies and the release when this really, really entered pop culture and everybody was talking about it. But it was just so funny to me that the movies, like, or the books, the story itself is trying to say all of these things about like celebrity and the games and like these relationships between Katniss and these boys. And then we as the consumers like went off in the direction it didn't want us to go. And people were like, Team Peeta, Team Gale. And I'm like, no, that's what the book doesn't want you to do. You're like actively participating in what the book is like. This is so, do you see how messed up this is? Like they're making her choose and people are invested in this thing. And then like all the stuff with the fashion and the like.
Mac was selling Capital makeup.
Yes,
books.
Yes.
Are you,
yes.
It was the most disgusting thing I've ever seen. Uh-huh. And this is, again, is someone who like appreciated the fashion it, both in, you know, in story and on the red carpet, but like that's different than selling.
Right. Yes. Like,
they literally doing the thing.
Yes. Right. Cinna deciding to like dress Katniss up as like as childlike as possible, like making like those, like that is one thing. Like that's the really like cool and insightful and like interesting thing to do with fashion that's happening in the story. And then then like out in the world, Hunger Games branded eyeshadow. I definitely have some Hunger Games nail polish.
Guys, 2012 was a different time. We didn't know how bleak the world could get. Okay, you'll have to forgive us.
Yeah, we were sweet summer children then.
I feel like I could honestly keep talking about this. I have notes that I haven't even touched, but
yeah, I have like a 20-minute rant about Finnick that I'll never get to do.
Oh no. Okay, and on that though, that brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you to Sam for joining us this week, and thank you all for listening. If you are enjoying this podcast, consider sharing it with your friends or reading or reviewing it wherever you are listening. We'd love to hear all of your thoughts on The Hunger Games. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com. You can also sign up to join our community on Patreon, which will give you access to our Discord, where we are hosting a buddy read for these three books, where we will then put all of these feelings that we didn't have a chance to talk about, we'll go put it in those buddy reads so you can come and join with us and chat about these books. You can also find us on Twitter at snark_squad. You can find me at My Name is Marines.
I am at Sweeney Says.
And I am at Democracy Diva.
This podcast is produced by the Snark Squad, and it is edited by Nicole Sweeney. The theme music that is playing us out right now is by Stefan Jones.